This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 205, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Ken Goodsword about his book, Fermi's Paradox Debunked, The Evidence for Extraterrestrial Life. Ken is the author of several books, including UFOs in the Bible, Before Roswell, and Fermi's Paradox Debunked. He has also authored commentaries on two of the major Sumerian creation myths, the Enuma Elish and the Atrahasis Epic. He is the host of the Dimension Fold YouTube channel, featuring discussions on many subjects and interviews with authors, researchers, alien abductees, and paranormal witnesses. Hi, Ken. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
We're going to talk about your book. It's called Fermi's Paradox Debunked, The Evidence for Extraterrestrial Life. It used to have a slightly different title, didn't it? But you changed it?
I put it out with two different titles because of Amazon's advertising policies. Yeah, so the actual title is Fermi's Paradox is Bullshit, but Amazon doesn't let you run ads on titles with swear words in them. So I made the other version, Fermi's Paradox Debunked, is just the only difference is that the title has that word taken out, so I can run ads on it.
For listeners who don't know, what is Fermi's Paradox?
You've probably heard it, even though you may not have heard the title of it. But Fermi's Paradox is a very famous quotation, and I'm using the word quotation very loosely because it's not actually a quotation, but supposedly the idea is, if there is life out there, where are they? How come they're not showing up? And so supposedly this is a paradox because a paradox is defined as two facts which contradict each other. So in the book, kind of the starting point for the book is that the whole concept of Fermi's paradox is fundamentally flawed. It's not actually a paradox. It's not actually a quote from Fermi. And just as a side note, Fermi was a famous physicist during World War II era. He was one of the people who were involved in things like the quest for nuclear power and things like that. So he was hanging out with Einstein and some other really famous physicists. And so he did apparently make an offhand comment to his buddies similar to this, but he wasn't approaching this as a paradox necessarily. And there was no such thing as Fermi's paradox until somebody else attached his name to it, probably without his permission. So the first chapter in the book is kind of about all that stuff, just to get the details of that story out of the way. But really, the book is more about exploring, is there actually any evidence for life in space? If so, what kind of evidence should we be looking for? And, we have there's institutions set up specifically to try to answer these questions, like SETI and a few other ones around the world. And really, there's a lot of work going into the exploration of trying to make contact with aliens, for one thing, but also just like that we haven't fully answered the question, is there life in space? But we kind of have, and I think that that a lot of those details have not really seen the light of day. And so we, throughout the various chapters in the book, we look at various lines of evidence for that.
And where he says, Fermi supposedly said, well, where are they? What was he thinking? What were they were thinking? That they would just be everywhere, like swarms of aliens in the galaxy, and we can't help but see them?
Well, yeah, this is part of the issue, is that, you know, the whole concept behind placing that frame of mind onto him, which I'm not sure is accurate, really depends on a lot of very kind of strange assumptions. Now, you also have to remember that this was in the 30s or early 40s that Fermi made this comment. This was before Roswell. This was before any of the kind of big UFO cases. So it wasn't a popular topic. There weren't hundreds of books written about UFOs. If you wanted to study UFOs, which I don't really think anybody was doing, but if you did want to, you would have to be like turning over a lot of rocks to try to find that information. It was not widely available. There were no UFOlogists, and Fermi certainly wasn't one, and neither were any of the guys that he was hanging around with. So these guys are physicists, you know, they're into math and they're into like hands-on experimentation involving the laws of physics and various fundamental forces and things like that. So they were interested in gravity and like subatomic, nuclear force and things like that. And they made great strides in it and were able to essentially usher in the atomic age. UFOs were not their specialty.
Yeah, so there's this idea then that, I mean, if they are out there, would we be able to find them? Do we have the technology to do it?
I feel like we're using the wrong technology. So we have, you know, we are used to using radio communication. And by radio, I also include like television, Wi-Fi, 5G, all of the communication technologies that we use, even satellite. Everything that we do is radio-based. So what that means is we're using the electromagnetic spectrum, which is essentially light, but we focus on certain wavelengths, areas of light that we could call radio. Radio is just a certain frequency range of light. But the thing is, radio is good for broadcast. It's really good for broadcast. It's actually not so good for point-to-point communication. So radio is actually not really the best technology to use for, say, your Wi-Fi or even your cell phone. But it's what we currently do use, and it does the job because we're talking about relatively small distances. So you know how you may have noticed that over the last decade or so, there's just been a lot more cell towers going up. And before that, there used to be, where I live anyways, once you drove out of town, you could easily lose your cell coverage. And then you would sometimes have to drive for an hour before you got it back when you get to the next town. And as we go, those gaps are all getting filled in by putting in more and more towers. But the reason for that is radio waves spread out, and as they spread, they get weak. So it's you can kind of visualize. Let's say you're standing in front of a pond. Maybe it's like a small duck pond or something like that. And if you take a rock and you throw it in, maybe you throw it 20 feet out. There's going to be a noticeable ripples, and as those ripples go away from where the rock splashed, they, by the time they get close to you at the shore, they've become very small, like almost unnoticeable. And so as they spread, there's only a certain amount of power that is generated when that rock breaks the surface of the water. That power then gets spread out. So the power is moving. As it's moving into a larger circle. And as the circle gets larger, the power is more spread out. This is exactly what happens with radio communication, with any radio wave, which is why, you know, once you get far away from the cell towers, you start to only get one bar, or eventually the signal completely drops. So if we were wanting to use radio technology to communicate to somebody in space, we can do it. We have done it. That's how we communicate to the International Space Station and, you know, on the moon missions and things like that. They use radio, but they have to pump out tons of power in order to get the wave to go that far. There are things that we can do to focus the wave into more of a direction. So rather than spreading out over the whole, you know, round area, we can kind of cut that round area down to maybe like a cone. And then it that helps a lot. But it's very difficult to get a very focused beam, and we have other ways of doing that. And so now we think about lasers. So if you have a laser, you can, it's similar to radio in that it's basically a light wave. But the thing about lasers is we do a lot of very advanced technology to focus that beam and essentially create what they call a cohesive beam. And it goes essentially in a straight line. So with a laser, you can shoot the laser beam for a very great distance without having any dissipation. This is what we should be using for communicating across space. Honestly, we should be using it to communicate to the International Space Station. It would take a lot less power. It does get a little bit more complicated because you have to make sure that you have a very, very tight focus. So the reason that SETI isn't finding very many, and I was going to say isn't finding any, but that's actually not correct. They are finding some, but the reason that SETI is not finding very many signals is because they're listening for radio stations. It's absolutely insane to think that if there was an advanced civilization, they were, let's say they're 400 light years away, they're not going to be stupid enough to use radio. It's just not the right way to do it. So if we wanted to monitor using better technology and have, I think, better chances of getting signals, what we should be doing is using laser listening devices. But the problem with that is now you kind of have to aim it at the right direction so that you're able to catch these very tight signals.
So there is a thing, this idea that radio waves travel at the speed of light, and that perhaps
right.
we started broadcasting lots of radio, let's say 100 years ago, and so that broadcast would now be 100 light years from us. But you're saying that the strength of that would dissipate so much that you pretty much wouldn't be able to detect it.
That's right. So if you were 100 light years away from here, there is zero chance that you're catching I Love Lucy or, you know, any of those old broadcasts that we sent out years ago. Those broadcasts were so weak they couldn't even make it across the country. You had to have repeater stations, which is why they invented the television network. Network TV only exists because radio signals need to be boosted. They're just not effective for long-range communication.
And also you talked about lasers, which kind of suggests radio has limited lifespan. And
absolutely,
other civilizations around us, they may have had radio and then stopped using radio. So it's like, if you think about the universe being 13.5 billion years old, and the window of using radio is just 200 years, the chances of being within that 200 years is pretty small.
Right. And even if, so let's say an alien craft happened to be flying past us, and they did pick up some radio waves, what are they going to do? They're going to look at, they're going to go, these guys are using radio. Let's get the hell out of here. You know, we don't want to deal with somebody who's so lacking in advancement.
And also there's that the lifespan of the use of radio, but there's also the lifespan of a civilization, isn't there? And the chances that they're around at the same time as us.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, I can't say one way or another, but it is entirely possible that there have already been advanced civilizations on Earth that have come and gone, because stuff only lasts so long. Like if there were suddenly to be a catastrophe today and everything was wiped out and all civilization was wiped out, essentially it's going to take a couple hundred years and things are start to really wear down and come into ruin. All of our skyscrapers, all of our cars, everything that we tend to build out of steel, it's going to start to rust. I don't know exactly how long it would take for a skyscraper to turn into complete rubble. But once you start looking at past the hundreds of years mark and into the thousands and 10,000s of years and even a million years, after a million years, there's going to be no trace of anything that we've done. Even if we use stone, which you know is very robust, very stone things can last for thousands of years. Certainly, look at the Great Pyramids in Egypt, and all around the world we have pyramids. These stone structures suggest that there was civilization. Now we can't really tell how advanced those civilizations were, and frankly, we're only guessing at the age of some of these things. And our guesses are based on other assumptions that we've made and some evidence that we may be interpreting completely wrong. So it's possible that the pyramids, for example, are much, much, much older than we think that they are. And it's possible that they also, whoever built those structures, might have also been constructing skyscrapers out of steel. Those have all rusted and fallen apart and gone away. Maybe they also had radios. Maybe they had computers. Maybe they had the exact same technology as we do. Even plastic does not last as long as people like to think it does. So I don't know if that's, you know, if it's, I'm not saying that that did happen or that didn't happen, but it's possible. And so when you consider that Earth is 4 billion years old, that could have happened many, many, many times. We could be the 10th or 100th cycle of human civilization that has advanced radio.
And is there a possibility that you could use quantum entanglement as a communication device?
Yes. Now, I don't want to talk too much about quantum stuff because, frankly, I don't understand it. I mean, I kind of do, but I also just kind of can't really believe it. I can't wrap my head around it. So I get the idea of, you know, having two particles entangled and then you separate them and then you should be able to communicate instantly. So I'm going to say theoretically that's totally possible. But I guess that's about as much as I can say about it.
Okay. The other side of it then is about, we're talking about us finding them, but
yeah,
I do feel they're here. So how did they find us? Because we're not exactly a particularly special star in the galaxy or special planet. What would stand out about us?
Right. So I like to think about Luke Skywalker. So he's on this crappy little desert planet with really nothing going on. They're just struggling to pull water out of the atmosphere. You know, they're out on the edge of the galactic rim. There's not much going on. Even there, they do have stormtroopers show up. And you know, they're hanging out at at whatever the spaceport is. And the only reason that those guys are there is because the Galactic Empire is everywhere, and they are making a point of making their presence infiltrate the entire galaxy. So even at a crappy little planet like Tatooine, they're here. They're there to basically to collect taxes. So it's quite possible that the same thing would happen here. This is what the Roman Empire was based on as well. Military presence, but the military presence really is just a way to enforce the tax collecting. So is it possible that they're here? Yeah. Why would they be here? Well, because they're greedy buggers like everybody else, like every other empire. But this is the interesting thing, too, is that bringing us back to the so-called paradox is how one half of the equation there is that where is everybody? Well, to ask that question, you have to ignore thousands of pieces of evidence because, like you mentioned, there is just an abundance of evidence that they are here or they have been here, and they have been here for many, many, many thousands of years. So one of my other books, a couple of my other books kind of hit on that topic, but very specifically, I wrote a book with Barbara DeLong, and based on the research of her late husband, Patrick Cook, who had devoted many years to gathering information about UFOs, UFO sightings. And he had this vast treasury of evidence that he had been collecting. After he passed on, Barbara had his notes, and I got talking to her one day, and we decided to put that into a book form. So we basically took Patrick's notes, and we arranged them into reverse chronological order. And so we put together this book. We call it Before Roswell, and it covers all, you know, there's this sort of this notion that Roswell was one of the first alien events, but it's totally not. So there's hundreds of other sightings and experiences, encounters that we look at going back chronologically, going back through time. And we go back thousands of years. So we're looking at encounters from the historical period during World War II. There's a whole bunch. There's a bunch from the 18th century. There's a bunch from the medieval period. And then back into the classical period, the Romans had several encounters that they wrote about that we still have their writings. And going back even long before that, so there is this long history of UFO evidence that I think you have to kind of you almost have to consciously decide to ignore, because it's getting to the point where it's very common knowledge that, you know, there's a lot of sources out here. If anybody has even a passing interest, they can find this information. So I think that this assumption of where is everybody is a very ignorant kind of an approach.
Do you find that looking at these reports, stories from thousands of years ago, it's a part of it is interpretation? Because they wouldn't have had our frame of reference for UFOs and other planets and things, so they're writing about gods, aren't they?
Well, sometimes it does seem that way. And it depends on, I think a lot of that depends on sort of the mental framework of the person who's writing it. So I do have another book called UFOs in the Bible. And Patrick Cook also wrote on this subject a little bit. Basically, in my book, I look at about 50 different encounters, UFO encounters, that are described in the Bible. And sometimes they are, there is this sort of religious theological framework around it. But actually, surprisingly, not as often as you would think. We tend to interpret all of these stories that way when we're in a religious setting and we're in reading a religious book. We think that they're talking about God. The reason we think that is because the people who translated those stories out of the Greek and Hebrew basically already had this, you know, interpretation, this assumption in their mind. And so they translated a lot of words into language that the original language does not actually track. So when you, if you were to read the, I'm especially interested in the Old Testament. There's a lot of Hebrew stories that are really, they're physical events, and they read exactly like a modern day UFO encounter. So you'll have a witness says, let's look at the prophet Ezekiel, for example. When he starts his story, he says, it starts very much like you would tell your story even now, as if you were writing a book about your UFO encounter, or even if you were reporting your encounter to the police or to the, you know, the MUFON network or anything like that. You would say, look, this was the date, this is where I was, and this is what I saw. And that's exactly what Ezekiel does. So he says, it was such and such a year in the reign of Whatchamacadinger the king, and I was standing beside the river, you know, whatever, whichever river he was beside, and I looked up in the sky, and I heard a sound, and I look in the sky, and I saw, and this is where it gets really strange, because he doesn't say, I saw a bright light and a loud voice that spoke to me, like, you know, this is kind of the typical God encounter that we would imagine. But that's not what he actually says. What he actually says is a strange disc-shaped metallic object, made, like they tended to use, call it, like they would say it was bronze or copper, because they didn't know about steel, they didn't have aluminum, but they could tell what things were metal. So he would say a copper or a bronze object came down from the sky, and with much fire and with a roar. So it wasn't so much that a God showed up and started talking to him. It was that there was a metal object that was flying that descended from the sky and that made a lot of noise and that was shooting fire. Or some of the descriptions are sound like rockets, like a, you know, fire and smoke. But in some of the other examples, it is more of like lights. So it's kind of more of a typical flying saucer with lights going around and things like that. And there's like 50 of these examples in the Bible. And a lot of them use this copper or bronze motif. A lot of them have the fire motif. A lot of them have lights. Sometimes they describe eyes. It has eyes all around it. And I'm not, like, we don't really know what that means. What has eyes all over it? God doesn't. But if you think of maybe eyes is a way for somebody to explain electric light. So, you know, if you didn't have technology and you saw suddenly saw something with flashing lights on it. You could describe it in terms of fire, or you could possibly describe that as in terms of eyes, especially if they're flashing because it looks like blinking eyes, right? So, yes, you're right. We totally have to we have to read these descriptions and think about what it looked like to them, how they're describing it, and not just assume that it is something else. Especially, we should not assume that it's something that they don't talk about at all, that they know about. So if we say that, okay, these people are ancient religious people who worship God and they understand God, then why wouldn't they say, yeah, this was God, right? So the fact that they don't do that is even stronger evidence that it's not a religious experience. It's actually a description of something that they're using, you know, these physical descriptions. It's not a spiritual experience. So I think we're drastically misinterpreting a lot of these biblical texts.
So I suppose it's an experience that's so far out from what their day-to-day life is like, they interpret it as something supernatural.
I don't think they interpreted it as supernatural. I think we are projecting that interpretation onto it thousands of years later when it gets translated into English.
When was the Ezekiel written, but also the New Testament? How far back in time does that go?
So the Ezekiel story took place during the Babylonian Empire. So ballpark, roughly speaking, around 500 BC. He describes metal. He describes chariots, which is essentially a transportation device. Ezekiel actually describes being picked up and transported in this flying metallic chariot and taken from Babylon to Jerusalem, which is about 600 miles away. And he describes this as happening very, very quickly. Like he doesn't say that it takes any kind of time whatsoever. So yeah, there's like, they are using the, you know, descriptions of things that are relevant to the time. So he talks about chariots, he talks about gold or metal. But he doesn't talk about God.
Well, I wanted to change the subject because there's something I was really interested in that I read in your book of Fermi's Paradox. It's that the Viking mission to Mars, there were two landers, that they both picked up evidence of life?
Yes. So was it both missions or was it just one mission? I can't remember, but there were three separate experiments that they put together specifically for this particular landing on Mars. And the mission had, you know, various goals, I guess. And I think they were collecting some soil samples and things like this. And, you know, running some experiments on the atmosphere and things like that. Basically, this was kind of the first time that we had landed on Mars. You know, now we have the Mars rover. The Mars rover would not have been possible if we hadn't had done these preliminary investigations earlier. So there's been a couple of different occasions where we've gone there looking for specific answers or at least specific questions. And on this first trip, there was two people in the NASA team. So these are scientists that work for NASA. Difficult positions to get to. You have to, you kind of have to be at the top of your game to get hired by NASA. And so these are people who knew what they were doing, and they wanted to, they were curious as to whether they would be able to detect any kind of essentially like biological, well, like bacteria, let's say. And I might be simplifying it slightly, but essentially they wanted to find any kind of evidence of microbial life. So, you know, very, very small single-celled organisms and such like that. So what they did was they designed three separate experiments to basically ask that question in three different ways. And so they were looking for specific chemical processes that that would take place, and they basically did that with injecting three different things into three small sites in the dirt there. So kind of like if you took a needle, stuck it in the sand, and injected a substance into the sand. My memory is failing me as to exactly what it was that they put in. But it was something like, you know, let's put a little bit of oxygen in, or let's put a little bit of some other simple chemical. And they were looking for, we're going to land on the sand. We're going to take a sample of the sand before we do anything. Then we're going to inject this material into the sand, and then we're going to wait a few minutes and then take another sample and bring that sample back. So they did that, and they were each of these experiments was designed scientifically to look for a very specific substance that would be there or not be there, and that would somehow tell them, okay, because we found this, then we know that this particular chemical reaction took place. And they did this because they were sort of expecting, okay, well, we know how biology works on Earth. If we were to do this experiment here, and they had already done the experiments on Earth, of course, so they knew what to look for. And basically just using like, okay, like if we do this in the lab, this is what happens because there's bacteria here, or there's a certain metabolic process that they're looking for. So for each of those three experiments, the results came back, and of course they're now in the lab back at NASA, back on Earth, and they're analyzing the results. They're, you know, running them through their computers and running them through various kind of processes of like, okay, well, let's make sure that, you know, we can tick every box, cross our T's, dot every I, and let's actually analyze what this means. And in all three of those experiments, they came to the conclusion that very convincingly, all three of these experiments pointed that there were biological processes at work in the sand on Mars. So they were ecstatic and very excited and wanted to, you know, call a press conference. Of course, this is after months of analysis. They weren't just like, oh yeah, yeah. Hey, cool. Look what we found. They did their homework. They were very careful about analyzing it and not jumping to conclusions. But after doing all that work, these two scientific experts from NASA said, "Yeah, we have found traces of biological processing." So that's not to say we found life, but kind of is. When they talked to their bosses about let's set up a press conference, the bosses said, maybe let's not. And they didn't want to, they didn't want that information going out to the public.
But the scientists stuck to their side of the evidence right till they died, didn't they?
Yep, absolutely. They believe what they saw, and they knew what they were doing. And at no point in the next, even in the next 50 years, at no point did they ever go, oh, well, you know, based on new information, we can now say that, you know, maybe we weren't, maybe we were wrong, maybe we screwed up. Nope, never happened. So they know what they were talking about. They found life on Mars, and this was in, like, in the, I believe it was in the 70s. And the strange thing is, yeah, that was in 1976. So the really strange thing is, after NASA found life on Mars, how long did they wait before they sent another mission to Mars?
Was it 20 years?
More than that. It was like until the Mars rover, like very recently. So it's like, it's kind of crazy. Like, we've been, supposedly, we've been looking for evidence of life outside of Earth. And then when we find it, we make sure we don't go back there. Like, what? I'm not a big conspiracy theorist, but, like, you have to be at some point where you're like, what? This is clearly a willing diversion away from fact-finding.
Well, sticking with NASA, I also saw something in the book about the Mercury program and Scott Carpenter saying that when the astronauts were in space, there was constant surveillance by UFOs. So what sort of information did you get on that?
So I am a little skeptical on some of those. So I don't really know what to make of it. And I guess let's look at the facts. The fact is that there have been many people have gone into space. I mean, there's been quite a few astronauts now, right? It's not just a handful of people anymore. So out of all of those people, there are quite a number of them who have claimed to see some strange things. So whether it is a base, some of the lunar astronauts apparently reported that there was some kind of alien base on the moon. Some astronauts, and including some very prominent ones, reported that there were ships around and, you know, kind of observing them, darting back and forth, and they had like very advanced technologies. They were able to just come and go as they pleased. Meanwhile, we're just kind of stuck in this little orbit. There's some that talk about sort of like a space snake or something, like just like some weird stuff. And these are people, these astronauts are very highly trained. They are, you know, not only scientifically trained, but also like psychologically. And they go through like extensive programs of making sure that they're not crazy. I mean, frankly, and also that they're able to, they have the skills to be able to like think about things rationally. And you know, they're not the type of people who are just going to see something and go off the deep end. So even, I don't know, even if like, I think that there is something about the concept of people seeing what they want to see, and we see what we believe or whatever. So on the one hand, there's like, I I don't trust everything that I hear. Because I know, like I've spoken to people who have shown me, pictures that they've taken, and I'm like, to me, that is like very weak evidence. So I don't always believe everything that people are trying to tell me. But also I think you do have to take into account that people aren't stupid. And especially if you have, highly trained people, I think you do need to, at least examine what evidence that they're showing and, what conclusions they're coming to. So I don't really know what to make of it.
Yeah. And there is some type of life found in orbit, isn't there? There's some, is it bacteria or something living on the outside of the space station?
Yeah, that's right. So just a couple of years ago, they were doing some maintenance on the International Space Station. They found some goo or some kind of dirt or whatever. Well, there shouldn't really be dirt piling up on a thing in space. You're going to expect dust, like, small particles of rock and stuff like that. But yeah, they were like, what is this stuff? And it ended up being, some bacteria growing on the outside of the space station. We don't know how that got there. We don't know if that got picked up off of some space dust that blew in from somewhere else. We don't know if they picked it up on the way out during the launch, and it just took, the space station's been up there for a long time. So it's a little bit sketchy to think that this bacteria is from the launch, like whenever that was, 30, 40, 50 years ago. But we do have to kind of look at all the evidence. So some of that other evidence is that we have also found bacteria or something like bacteria inside asteroids that have come from either from very far out in our solar system or possibly even from outside of our solar system. And we've also found like asteroids will crash into Mars, and chunks of that rock will because Mars' gravity is kind of low, and also from the moon this happens. So both Mars and the moon, if rocks crash into them, sometimes dust basically escapes off of that planet and can also make its way to Earth. So that is something that seems like it would be rare, but it definitely happens. We have a lot of non-controversial scientific evidence that the chunks of rock do transfer from Mars to Earth, and some of those chunks of rock may also contain biological molecules. I don't think that was 100% confirmed, but it's possible. There is almost 100% confirmation of biological molecules in asteroids that have come from long distance, like ultimate origin unknown. There's also evidence of, and this is a little bit interpretive because we have to rely on radio telescopes, and we've already talked about radio and things like that, but through radio telescopy, we are able to basically analyze the light that bounces off of various things in space. And this is a technology that we can use for pretty long range, because even though that radiation is spreading out, as we talked about earlier, Just the amount of power of radiation that comes from. So now we're talking about places like, what did they call it? Like the Andromeda system, and where there are like these very dense gaseous regions in space, and people who are studying that are also finding evidence that could be, but could also probably have different implications, but possibly indicating that there might be biological molecules far, 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 far away. Like we're talking about like hundreds of light years away. And so if there are these molecules out in space, they probably didn't come from Earth, but maybe it's more likely that they're, that those things are kind of everywhere we look. There's biology out everywhere in space, and it's going everywhere. It's all over the place, and that's it's more reasonable to say that that's where life came to Earth. Like, it's not from Earth. We are the result, not the cause.
The stuff that's on the south side of the space station, that shows that this stuff can live in a vacuum and different temperatures that are quite extreme to what we're used to.
That's right. Another example of that is the tardigrades. So some of your listeners might be familiar with tardigrades just because they're really cool. So tardigrades are these little tiny animals. They live on Earth, and you can probably even find them if you have a you don't need a super powerful one, but you need some kind of microscope and basically some pond water, and you can probably get yourself some tardigrades and have some little pets. But these things are really cool. They're these tiny little animals. They eat algae and bacteria and things like that that are just floating around in the water. And the interesting thing about them is that you can basically freeze them or even like completely dry, like mummify them, and they'll just sit there basically dead. We've done this for years. I don't know how long they could last, but we've done experiments where they took some frozen ones and they took some completely dried out ones, stuck them on the shelf for 10 years. 10 years later, okay, let's see what we can do here. They take them off the shelf, they thaw them out, they spray a little bit of nice water on them, and they come back to life. Like it's crazy. These things are like almost unkillable. So the Chinese astronauts took some of these tardigrades to the moon when they went a couple years back. And the report that we got back from China is that they accidentally released some tardigrades. So there's tardigrades on the moon, and I fully expect that in a few years the Chinese team will go back and we'll see how they're doing. And I also fully expect that they'll be doing just fine. And who knows, they might have multiplied. I don't know how many they actually released, but it wouldn't surprise me if there were billions of them up there now.
Was that from a Chinese probe that landed on the moon?
Yes, it was. So, the Chinese sent a moon mission up there not too long ago, I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, it's been great having you back on the podcast. We were talking about your book, Fermi's Paradox Debunked, The Evidence for Extraterrestrial Life.
Yes, sir. And there's other stuff in there that we didn't really get a chance to talk about too much, but I'd just like to mention there's a chapter on the existence of water outside of Earth, outside of our solar system, And one another chapter about sort of the concept of habitable planets, which I think is really interesting because of the recent developments that have been going on there. 20 years ago, we did not think that there were any other planets anywhere in the universe that we could possibly live on. That has changed dramatically. So that now there are literally hundreds of planets that we've found, that we've identified, and that are, it looks to a high degree like they are potentially capable of sustaining life.
So it could be that life is just everywhere.
Absolutely.
People can get your books on Amazon, can't they?
That's right. So Amazon has all my stuff. If you Google me, you'll find most of my books there. You can also check out my website directly. It's dimensionfold.com. And it has links to my books as well as some other interesting projects that I'm doing.
Fantastic. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Simon. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
That was an interview with Ken Goodsword about his book, Fermi's Paradox Debunked, The Evidence for Extraterrestrial Life. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. When you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue. They are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, and it's on Amazon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.